Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them old trucks. Make them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They'll never stay home and they're always alone. Even with someone they love. Cowboys ain't easy to love and they're harder to hold. And they'd rather give you a song.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the City of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered a 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations went up on Monday.
Although you may be paying more for purchases, your pay may not be keeping up with the trend. According to a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than 2 decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the half-million mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. And after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
The League of Women Voters has long been a voice of reason and moderation in American politics. But the leaders of the League recently received a searing blast of raw outrage directed at them, coming from a surprising source, their own members. From all across the country, angry LWV members fired off calls, emails, and several shrieks of horror at the hierarchy, decrying a decision the leaders made last year to endorse the use of paperless electronic voting machines in our elections. Since that endorsement was made, there's been a growing awareness that these corporate-owned and operated computer voting systems are wide open to hackers, manipulations, vote theft, and other problems. Indeed, California authorities have banned the use of machines provided by Diebold, Inc. after finding unauthorized software in them and experiencing malfunctions that jeopardized the outcome of elections this spring. Most alarming is the fact that electronic voting provides no paper record of each ballot cast, so there's no way to track the integrity of the vote in case there are suspicions of tampering or miscounts. As a result, there's been a fast-spreading grassroots rebellion against entrusting our democratic electoral process to the handful of corporations that program and supply these treacherous machines. The demand is that the devices must include a verifiable paper record of every vote cast. The League of Women Voters has now joined this rebellion. At its recent biannual convention, some 800 delegates from its local chapters voted overwhelmingly to rescind their leader's earlier endorsement of paperless voting machines. They passed a resolution demanding voting systems and procedures that are secure, accurate, recountable, and accessible. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's a testament to the integrity of grassroots groups like the League that they can inform themselves and correct their course. Now, if only our corporate and political leaders would do the same, maybe we'd get a little integrity back in our electoral process.
When I started this company, our mission was to be the most useful and most ethical provider in the financial services business.
Charles Schwab, founder and chairman of the Charles Schwab Corporation.
When you're dealing with people's money, when you're dealing with their financial dreams, you've got to hold it with the greatest of care.
With industry-leading equity research, trusted investment professionals, and online equity trades as low as $9.95, Charles Schwab offers investors a better choice when it comes to low-cost investing.
It's about service. It's about best value. It's about ethics. It's all those things. That's what we're about every day.
To learn more about Schwab's new lower-cost trading options, call 1-800-7-SCHWAB or stop by a local branch today.
For pricing details, visit Schwab.com. $9.95 for Schwab Trader CT clients or those with $1 million in assets. Advice and certain research available for a fee. Charles Schwab & Co., Inc., member SIPC and NYSE.
And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast. You know, George Bush has not yet told us or his loyal minions what his plans are for the next 4 years. What would you do different, Mr. Bush? Or what would you do in addition? There's a lot of speculation. Well, you know, okay, he's screwed up Medicare. Next, he's going to screw up Social Security. That's, pretty much a given. But as the Washington Post noted this weekend, with the election less than 4 months away, one of the biggest mysteries surrounding the president's campaign is what he would actually do if he wins a second term. Bush's failure to detail a second-term agenda represents a stark contrast to his previous campaigns, in which he set out a handful of priorities almost from the opening day and rarely deviated from, notes the Post. And apparently this is a strategic thing, a political thing. You lay the stuff out at the convention. But it's also, it'll give them an opportunity to see how the Democrats position themselves, so then they can do the polls, and then they can figure out what are the things that they should lay out. There's a certain political sense to that. I mean, you know, it's the Karl Rove way. 4 years ago, his agenda was tax cuts, education reform, faith-based initiatives, missile defense, and Social Security reform. But all of that was actually laid out long before the GOP convention this time around. And no doubt, I mean, he's floated this stuff about going to Mars and the moon. And we'll see. His health care proposal is, let's get rid of those awful trial lawyers who constitute 0.1% of our total insurance expenditures. Yes, that's tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, but, you know, gee, that'll solve things, won't it? As over the last 3 years, the average family's insurance payments have gone up 44%.
Another major proposal, banning gay marriage. You probably see that. Run to the base. Is he going to try and run as a compassionate conservative? I'm predicting you're going to see this phrase, ownership society. Yeah, you too can be an entrepreneur. You too can own. In other words, I mean, see, it's really a phony thing. You can give your money to somebody like major Republican contributor Citicorp, and they will invest it for you in other places. But, you know, see, people bought into that in 1929 and got a rude surprise in October of that year. Anyhow, I have a theory about what George Bush's bumper sticker is going to be. I doubt it's going to be overt. But George W. Bush, four more wars. And we're seeing the beginning of it already. No, seriously, with the idea of, hey, there's something going on here in Iran. It's fascinating to me how the Sydney Morning Herald, one of the largest newspapers in Australia, sort of like the New York Times of Australia, right, keeps... Well, okay, maybe the Boston Globe of Australia, keeps breaking really major American stories. Last week, they broke the story about how the Prime Minister of Iraq, Alawi, had put his gun to the heads of six men, one after another, lined them up against a wall and shot each one of them in the head and killed them at a police station about 3 weeks before he was appointed Prime Minister. Now, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, 6 months ago, George Bush was saying, United Nations, we won't have anything to do with them. We're going to do, stay the course, do this our own way. Yeah, this is an American solution. And John Kerry says, they say to Kerry, what would you do? And Kerry says, well, I'd bring the UN in, and I'd have the UN, put together a government that had some legitimacy, that wasn't an American-appointed government, like Paul Bremer was trying to do, and then hold elections as quickly as possible and get Arab states in there and get, you know, the American troops out. In a way that isn't going to cause major disruption. And, of course, just a few months after Kerry proposed that, George Bush suddenly is standing at the front door of the UN, knocking on, hey, Kofi, can we get your guy to please appoint, and of course, now the government there was appointed by the UN. But anyhow, the Sydney Morning News broke this story, but I digress, right? The Sydney Morning News, this was in the Sunday paper, the Sunday Herald. The Sydney Morning Herald, excuse me. The President George Bush, this is the lead sentence. President George Bush has promised that if reelected in November, he will make regime change in Iran his new target. Regime change in Iran. Yeah, for those of you who remember the last worldwide administration that was into regime change of all their neighbors. Many of you are probably not old enough to remember when this was a big hit. Never Say Never Again. It's like 1937 or 38. You're wondering why I'm playing this song, right? 13 minutes past the hour, by the way. This song... I walked away and said goodbye. See, this is the classic version. I was hasty, wasn't I? I missed you. This song was actually broadcast in 1943 into England from Germany. Now you say, now why would they play a big band classic? Well, here's why.
Here is a new version sent to us by a disillusioned Englishman. We'll never say never again. Cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again with you.
Here we are at war again with you.
We'll never say never fight wars again. Cause here we are at war again. It's just a thing that Churchill made us do.
Churchill made us do it.
We thought to war we'd say goodbye, but war ain't fun and that's no lie. We like to live and we hate to die, but it's all up now and that too is no lie. We'll never say never again, again, 'cause here we are at war again. Up to our necks in war again, and we can't pull through.
Now, this great piece of, yeah, great, I guess, depending on your point of view, great piece of German propaganda. I'm proposing this for George W. Bush's next term as the official theme music. As the Sydney Sunday Herald says, a U.S. government official speaking on condition of anonymity said, if George Bush is reelected, there'll be much more intervention in the internal affairs of Iran. The Iranian government announced this week that it successfully eradicated all al-Qaeda cells operating in the country. But the statement comes as leaked reports from the U.S. 9/11 Commission show definite links between Iran and the 9/11 terrorists. And this is going to be the big story, you know, George Bush. Gee, those terrorists, they're up to things here in Iran. We need to do something about that. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, by the way, if you have thoughts on this or other issues. In fact, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan is on the line. Hey, Rick, listening to us on WTKG, no doubt.
Yes, good day to you.
How are you? What's up?
Glad you're on the air.
Thank you. Me too.
I don't know where we start with this administration. And have you heard this latest trial balloon they're sending out there that they may have to postpone the elections because of terrorism? I wanted to kind of bounce a little bit of this off of you now. There have been reports not only about interfering in Iran, but also that al-Qaeda has been trying to recruit Americans. Now, here's what I see could happen. You could have a terrorist attack, probably against the Democratic Convention, because they wouldn't want to hurt any Republicans. And then if they were found out to be Americans, people would say, well, this can't be al-Qaeda. And then they would say, well, but we warned you that they would be recruiting Americans, and therefore they could postpone the election. Now, if they postpone the election at all, when would it be safe to have the election? See, they could just say, well, we don't really know. You know, maybe we'll have to postpone the elections altogether because we're under such a tremendous threat here. And remember when Bush was joking during the 2000 campaign? Well, a dictatorship would be nice if I was the dictator. Now, he was supposed to be joking, but...
Well, actually, here he is.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Well...
It's amazing what this man can get away with.
Yeah, I know. It really is remarkable. I shouldn't laugh. Rick, you raise a couple of interesting points. I think one of them is, you know, a lot of primaries were actually postponed or done away with here this year. The Republican primaries. There's a whole series of them.
Okay, you ran unopposed.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, there were other candidates who wanted to have primaries, but the Republicans just said, no, we're not going to have a primary. And they claimed that the reason that they were doing it was because they wanted to save money. But it turns out that in those states where they actually did hold Republican primaries, George Bush was losing somewhere, you know, depending on the state, anywhere from 10 to 30% of the vote. In New Hampshire, it was over 30% of the people in New Hampshire voted for somebody other than George Bush in the Republican primary for president of the United States.
And the liberal media never told us that.
No, well, here I am, the liberal media, and I'm telling you that. In fact, I've got the whole story. I was going to get into this actually in the second or third hour of the program today. So, number one, the Republicans are really good at postponing elections. They've already done it this year. And number two, you know, the amazing thing is the subtext to this, Rick. It's the subtext of that primarily the Republicans in the administration have been putting out. Al-Qaeda is going to attack the United States in order to try to influence our elections. The subtext to that is, therefore, Al-Qaeda's in favor of John Kerry. I mean, that's what they want people. That's the takeaway message, right?
Bill O'Reilly has kind of insinuated that too.
Oh yeah, well, and all these right wingers are saying this. But the reality is, if you look at what happened in Spain, the first of all, the race was a dead heat. In fact, the socialist candidate, the left of center candidate, he's far left of center actually, had about a 1% lead going into the election.
Right.
Then the bombing happens, and over 90% of the Spanish electorate was absolutely angry with the Spanish government for sending their soldiers into war. You'll recall that you know it had been 2 or 3 months before that what was it, 8 or 9 of their soldiers died all at the same time. They had a whole state funeral. King Juan Carlos came out, the whole bit.
And then this bombing occurs, you know, a few days before the election, and the government says, it's ETA, which ETA, which is the Basque separatist group
right.
that has been, you know, doing terrorist stuff
sure.
for maybe 50 years. The thing is, though, ETA had never before attacked civilians. ETA always attacked military targets because they viewed it as a war between one state and another.
Sure.
And everybody in Spain said, come on, this is not ETA. They don't do this. And the government was like, yes, this is ETA. And okay, you lied to us about Iraq. Now you're lying to us about the... And people threw the bums out because they were liars. And it had nothing to do with, you know, gee, Al-Qaeda got their way. But, you know, the cons want you to think that so because, there, you know, apparently there is a good chance that something will happen between now and the election, and they're going to try and spin it to the advantage of George W. Rick, we got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Thanks for listening there. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 20 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense. Common sense! Oh, my goodness. In a talk radio program. Yes, right here. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told. If you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
an ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, a call to take back America by Tom Hartman, available in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. What is war peace, or is peace war? Which is it, George?
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Ah, okay. Thank you. Every now and then, you just need a little clarification. And I think a lot of the Republicans actually are sort of a little more aligned with Daffy Duck's take on this.
Now what am I going to do?
Yeah, see, for example, as Rick pointed out, or Rick reminded me, Kansas, Colorado, and Utah canceled their 2004 presidential primaries by action of their Republican-controlled legislatures. And then once the presidential campaign got going, this John Nichols reported about this in The Nation, an article titled A Penchant for Canceling Elections. Once the primaries were already going, the RNC and the state Republican committees in Florida, New York, Connecticut, Mississippi, South Dakota, South Carolina, and Puerto Rico canceled the Republican primaries. Now, a lot of people ask, why? Why cancel a primary when you've got, you've got a lot of people running for different things. You contested primary races, and why were the Republican primaries canceled? Well, the official line was to save money. But that's bogus. As the governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, said, as she vetoed a Republican advanced bill to cancel the Republican primary in Arizona, she said, Arizona can well afford the price of democracy. But the Republicans really didn't want the people to speak. And here may be why. In New Hampshire, 30% before. I was mixing numbers up in my head. It was 3,000 New Hampshire Republican primary voters, registered Republicans in New Hampshire who voted in the primary, wrote in the name of John Kerry, and 22% of everybody who voted in the Republican primary in New Hampshire voted for somebody other than George Bush. In Rhode Island, it was 15% of the Republican primary voters who rejected George Bush. 10% of them in Massachusetts, 10% of the Republicans in Oklahoma said, I'll take anybody but Georgia. We'll pick. And 10% of those in Idaho, registered Republicans voting in the Republican primary, voted for somebody other than George Bush for president. Even in his home state of Texas, 50,000 registered Republicans voted in the Republican primary for somebody other than George Bush. So you can see why, A, the Republicans aren't talking much about the Republican primaries, which were actually held in some states, and George didn't do so well. Number one, they're not talking about that. And number two, what this does is it says there really is dissent within the ranks. There really are Republicans who are very concerned about what's going on in the United States and what the future may bring. For example, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency under two Republican presidents, George Bush and Nixon and Ford, Russell E. Train, head of the EPA under the Nixon administration and the Ford administration, said Bush's record on the environment is so dismal he's going to cast his vote for Democrat John Kerry. This guy, a lifelong Republican. In 1988, he was the co-chairman of Conservationists for Bush Sr. He accused Bush of weakening the Clean Air Act, this current George Bush, and said the president's record falls far short of those set by former Republican presidents from Theodore Roosevelt to George H.W. Bush, who supported revised standards for clean air. So you got Republicans jumping the ship. And then, you know, surprise, surprise, the Republicans start investigating, you know, running up these trial balloons last week about, well, should we cancel the election? What would happen if we canceled the election? Maybe we should cancel the election. Get a, you know, half a dozen different sources talking about it. Maybe. Maybe that's, you know, I think it's been shot down, that balloon. Let's hope for the sake of democracy. But let's also get back to George's plans for Iran right after this. Stay tuned.
For more than 27 years, the progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the city of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered a 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations up on Monday.
Although you may see report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than 2 decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever, for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the half-million mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds peaceful. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds
Revolution in the ballot box, hopefully. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. A program today brought to you by the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research. We're going to hear a little more about stem cells in the next hour, actually. This is really could be one of the big issues of the century. Anyhow, the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, you can find them, more information about them at www.cascr.org. Check them out. Well, Ralph Nader, yesterday I reported to you that the Nader had missed it with the Reform Party. It was the Reform Party in Michigan that Nader was, you know, trying to run with and on and, you know, whatever. Who's going to get him on the ballot? And he didn't quite make it. He had to have 30,000 signatures, and he had like 5,000 or 6,000. And so, to the rescue, the Republican Party of Michigan. They went out and they got 43,000 signatures. And today, Ralph Nader, two interesting things in today's news. I don't know if they happened yesterday afternoon or this morning, but one, Ralph Nader said, oh, cool, I'll take those signatures, even if it's from the Republicans. And number two, equally amazing or interesting, the Democratic Party is going to challenge it because the law says that you can't spend more than $5,000 to get somebody on the ballot, and they say the Republicans spent more than that. Apparently, well, not apparently, I mean, I'm guessing at this point. If the Democrats are saying that the Republicans spent more than $5,000 to get the signatures, odds are they probably did the same thing that Darrell Issa did in California, which was not illegal in California, which is he said, I'll pay $1 a signature for people to get signatures on the ballot to with recall Gray Davis. Remember that? And he spent over $1 million to get the signatures. And he thought he was going to run for governor and win, right? And Schwarzenegger put an end to that. And he had that great photo scene of, a video clip of Darrell Issa sobbing his eyes out on television after he'd spent $1 million of his own money so that he could run for governor. Anyhow, I'm guessing that the GOP was, you know, hired some group and paid him, you know, 50 cents or a buck a signature. And 43,000 signatures, that adds up. It's more than 5,000. So the Democratic Party is coming in and saying, no, you can't do that. It's not right. It's not fair. It's not legal. But is George... So anyway, the plot thickens. And I think the other thickener in the plot here is the situation in Iran. Now, you've got the state television in Iran yesterday saying that they snatched a bunch of al-Qaeda supporters. And the Iranian government says it's arrested and repatriated hundreds of al-Qaeda suspects in the past 2 years in a display of willingness to bring terrorism in the Middle East under control. As it reminds you of the weeks before we attacked Iraq, when Saddam was saying, hey, you want oil? I'll sell you oil. Hey, you want inspectors? I'll give you inspectors. You want to come in here? You can come in anywhere you want. You want your businesses to do business in Iraq? We'd love to have, you know, anything you want. Just please don't bomb it. Oh, no. Here we come. And is Iran next? 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. You'd like to call in. Jim in Ocala, Florida is on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey.
I like to throw this out there and see what you think about this. I believe that Osama had rather keep George Bush in the White House.
Oh, sure.
I believe that George Bush has done more to advance Osama's cause than John Kerry ever would. I believe they're afraid of John Kerry. That's my opinion. But I want to see what you think about that.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
I heard that Mike Malloy got a gig. And thanks, Tom. Appreciate your show.
You're welcome. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, I heard to Mike being back on the air, and that's, you know, for those who know him, and I think that's wonderful. And there's no doubt in my mind. And, in fact, there was, and it was widely circulated. I don't have it right here in front of me, but I've read it on the air at least a half a dozen times. One of the al-Qaeda groups came out and essentially endorsed George W. Bush. This was about 3 months ago, I'd say. It was right around the time it became obvious that Kerry was going to be the nominee. And they actually attacked Kerry. They said that Kerry would use lies to turn the world against al-Qaeda, whereas George Bush would honorably challenge them or some such thing. And it was basically an endorsement of George W. Bush from al-Qaeda. Of course, I mean, he has done more for recruiting for al-Qaeda by attacking Iraq
who represented no threat to us at all. They just happened to be sitting on an absolutely enormous amount of oil, as Dick Cheney pointed out.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and now it's looking like maybe even it's more than Saudi Arabia, because back in 1987, as I recall, Saudi Arabia suddenly, in about a three-month period, suddenly their oil reserves went up about a third on paper. But there were no discoveries of new fields. The only thing that was happening was that that quarter, Saudi Arabia was applying to the World Bank for a loan. They needed more money. And so there's pretty broad consensus among people in the oil industry. T. Boone Pickens was on TV a couple, three nights ago, Saturday or Sunday night, talking about this. That what happened was Saudi Arabia basically inflated their reserves. And they really don't have as much oil as they say they do. And that's why, you know, the price of oil is still above $40 a barrel and isn't going to go down. I fully expect to see $50 a barrel oil by the end of this year. Fully expect it. Maybe higher. And so, you know, here we've got now Iran. And now, should George W. Bush's slogan be four more wars? Right? Four more wars! Four more wars! Four more. There was embarrassment for the Bush administration last week, writes the Sydney Morning Herald. When it emerged, a tight deadline was being pushed for the capture of Osama bin Laden to generate headlines during the Democratic convention. Remember when that story came out? That several independently verified from several different members of the Pakistani intelligence service, saying that they had been approached by the administration, the Bush administration, and told that there was huge rewards in store for them if they could produce Osama bin Laden between July 25th and July 30th during the Democratic National Convention. Surprise, surprise. Right. And, you know, the Republicans will figure out some way. I guarantee you. You can take this to the bank. It's never happened before, but they will this year. They will figure out some way to either disrupt the Democratic convention or to steal headlines from it. Whether it's getting a bunch of young Republicans out there in the streets to do battle with people, or whether it's, you know, discovering some terrorist that they just happened to have arrested a month and a half ago, or, you know, Osama or whatever. There's going to be some strategy, particularly the day that John Kerry is giving his big speech. There's going to be some strategy to try to control the news cycle. Mark my words. And Pakistani security forces had apparently been given deadlines to capture bin Laden before the U.S. general election in November, according to U.S. sources, that also. And this was interesting. Khalid al-Harbi, remember him? He was the guy who was in the video with Osama bin Laden right after 9/11 going, hey, look at that. That's kind of cool, those towers. These two guys, you know, congratulating each other. And this guy was just brought back to Saudi Arabia from Iran. From Iran. And Iran is trying to take credit for, you know, essentially turning him over to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia had offered an amnesty. If you're an al-Qaeda person and you come in now, we won't prosecute you. And so this guy's in Saudi Arabia now, and he's vanished. Just like all those members of the bin Laden family that George W. rounded up 2 days after 9/11, when all the airspace in the United States was shut down, 140-some-odd members of the bin Laden family and their friends rounded them up and flew them out of the United States into Saudi Arabia without ever being interrogated by the FBI, without having to go through customs, just the whole nice, neat, tight little package. And to this day, those people have never been interrogated. Of course, several of them are former business partners of George W. Bush. One of them, Salam bin Laden, was the one who bailed George W. Bush out when his Armbusto oil company was going down the tubes. Others are business partners of his father. So, gee, maybe that has something to do with it. In the meantime, speaking of Iran, the next, you know, Act 4, right, the next war. A grand jury, this is a Reuters story by Matt Daly, yesterday's paper. A grand jury issued a subpoena to oilfield services company Halliburton Corporation, seeking information about its Cayman Islands unit's work in Iran, where it's illegal for U.S. companies to operate. See, Dick Cheney started this thing. When he was president of Halliburton, the United States government, during the Clinton administration, passed a law saying that it was illegal for an American company to do business with states that sponsored terrorism. Illegal. And so Enron really kind of invented this whole thing in many ways, although it wasn't, brand new. I mean, offshore tax shelters have been around for a long time. But companies started taking subsidiary companies. Kellogg Brown and Root, for example, is a company that goes way back, to the early part of the 20th century when Brown, I forget his first name, had come up with this, technique. Well, Halliburton actually originally came up with the first technique for cementing oil wells. And anyhow, it was an old Texas company. It was acquired by Halliburton. And they moved it to the Cayman Islands. Now, why would they do that? Well, they did it for two reasons. One, they no longer have to pay U.S. income taxes. And this is the company, by the way, that is feeding our troops in Iraq, that is supplying the mail to our troops in Iraq, that's doing most of the reconstruction in Iraq, KBR. They renamed it KBR. It's no longer called Kellogg Brown and Root. When they moved it to the Caymans, or thereabouts. So they moved it to the Cayman Islands, and then they said, hey, if we're a Cayman Island company and not a U.S. company, although, their presence in the Cayman Islands basically is a post office box. Their offices are here in the United States. But they said, if we're a Cayman Island company, we don't have to worry about that law that says that we can't do business with terrorist states. Now, this was in the late 90s. Dick Cheney was president of Halliburton, which owned KBR. And so Cheney starts doing business with Saddam Hussein and Iran and Libya. $87 million worth of business with Saddam. Well, this year, apparently, according to the annual report, must have been last year, the company said, this is from the Reuters story, the company said in its annual report that revenues from its subsidiary business in Iran, that country that is, a state sponsor, the part of the axis of evil, Iran amounted to about $80 million. So Halliburton, through its KBR subsidiary, not an American company, is still doing business with terrorist states. It's continuing the tradition that Dick Cheney started when he was CEO. And now the United States government, a grand jury, wants to know the details. As Reuters reports, Halliburton's engineering and construction unit, KBR, formerly called Kellogg Brown and Root, is also the subject of a U.S. Justice Department and a Security and Exchange Commission investigation for possible overcharges for food and fuel service contracts in Iraq, where it's the largest contractor. Halliburton said it would comply with the subpoena and reiterated it believed its links to Iran through the Cayman Islands unit were in compliance with applicable laws and regulations. In fact, back in October of 2003, some of Halliburton's shareholders started getting a little testy. And they said, we really don't think this company that we own stock in should be doing business in Iran. Halliburton, in a report issued in October 2003 in response to shareholder complaints about its Iranian link, Halliburton said it was not illegal for U.S. companies' independent foreign subsidiaries to conduct business in Iran and that it had taken steps to isolate the U.S. operation and managers from its work there. Time will tell. Now, in the meantime, what does Iran say about all this? More importantly, what Iran is saying is, hey, we don't have any terrorists. We got rid of them. We just closed the last cells. We'll do anything we can to comply. What is Iraq saying about this? We've got this new independent state, Iraq, IRAQ. Well, today's Reuters, Dateline Dubai, Iraq is ready to retaliate against countries it accuses of supporting violence racking the country, the country's defense minister warned Tuesday. Hazem al-Shalam mentioned no countries by name, but accused old foe Iran of, quote, blatant interference, end quote. Iraq also complained about guerrilla fighters entering the country from Syria. And the defense minister was quoted in the London-based Shark al-Awswat newspaper, an Arabic-language newspaper published in England. We are prepared to move the arena of the attacks on Iraq's honor and its rights to those countries. They, the Iranians, confess to their presence, to the presence of their spies in Iraq who have a mission to shake up the social and political situation, the defense minister said. Iranian intrusion has been vast and unprecedented since the establishment of the Iraqi state. A new Iran-Iraq war? Is that what's in the, is that, you know, I mean, there was one. It was 8 years long, in 1980 to 1988. 1987, the year before it ended, Don Rumsfeld flew over there. Oh, I'm sorry, that was in 78. That was before then. Flew over there and shook Saddam's hand. Yeah, no, that was 87. That's right. Yep, sure enough. Here we go again, folks.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down, and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Tom Hartman will be joining the exceptional faculty of The Great Rethinking, The Prophets Oxford, taking place the weekend of September 10th through 12th at Oxford University, England. You are invited to join Tom Hartman in Oxford, along with other leading visionaries, including Vandana Shiva, Helen Caldicott, and Rupert Sheldrake, among others, to rethink and reshape our collective future. The Great Rethinking Oxford premise is that this tumultuous time in our human history may be crafted into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
A state trooper with a good eye stops zebra mussels at a way station. I'm Richard Hoops for Earthwatch Radio. Zebra mussels invaded the Great Lakes as stowaways in the ballast water of ocean-going ships. They might invade the Pacific Northwest by way of recreational boats and interstate highways. In May, an officer of the Washington State Patrol found live zebra mussels on the side of a boat from Tennessee. It was being hauled through a port of entry on Interstate 90. The discovery illustrates the need for boaters everywhere to take responsibility for cleaning their watercraft. Pam Meacham is an invasive species expert with Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife. She says zebra mussels are a huge ecological and economic problem. They're prolific, and they can change aquatic ecosystems and clog water intake pipes. Meacham says state troopers in Washington are trained to look for zebra mussels on boats at way stations. But that only works for boats that are hauled by large trucks that have to stop for inspection. Meacham says smaller trucks don't have to stop.
Vehicles that are less than 26,000 pounds do not have to stop at the scales for the state patrol. There are a lot of people out there with large pickup trucks that are able to haul 30 to 35-foot boats, so there are a number of boats coming through that could be coming in from infested areas with zebra mussels that we're not catching.
Zebra mussels can live out of water for days and can survive a long trip on a boat or trailer. Meacham says that means boaters have to take action to keep them from spreading.
If you wish to have fishable and swimmable waters, then you need to take some responsibility for seeing to it that you do not spread invasive species that will damage your waters.
Meacham says boaters need to be sure their watercraft are cleaned thoroughly before they hit the road. This radio is a service of the Sea Grant Program and the Gaylord Nelson Institute at the University of Wisconsin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Had another dream about a lion at the door. They weren't as frightening as they were before, but I'm thinking about eternity.
Welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Our program brought to you in part by futurist Benjamin Krim. Get a free audio from him and his organization there by calling 1-888-242-8272. President Bush says the U.S. is investigating whether Iran had a role in the 9/11 terror attacks based on reports that at least eight of the hijackers passed through Iran. This is going to be the talking point for the rest of the week. I guarantee it. We will continue to look and see. Boy. His speaking sounds sort of like, you know, second-grade readers. Anyway, we will continue to look and see if the Iranians were involved, said George W. And although the CIA has discounted a link between Iran and 9/11, here we go again, right? Here we go. It's starting. The president says, quote, "We're digging into the facts to determine if there was one, a link between Iran and 9/11. Yes, yes, folks, the campaign slogan should be George W. Bush, four more wars. The 9/11 Commission investigating U.S. intelligence, according to New York Daily News, the article by Richard Sisk in today's paper, and readiness for the attacks is expected to report later this week that at least eight of the 19 hijackers passed through Iran before coming to the U.S. And that Iran had something to do with al-Zahari, the alleged number two al-Qaeda guy, giving safe passage to several 9/11 hijackers. You know, the question that I'm still scratching my head about is when we theoretically had bin Laden cornered in Tora Bora. There were news reports that lasted one day, about aircraft flying into and out of the Tora Bora region and heading in the direction of Pakistan that the United States military did nothing about, and nobody knew what they were, where they were coming from. But I digress. See, that, in my opinion, that's when Osama made his getaway, and it may well have been a getaway that we were just fine with at the time. Gee, let's wait and get him just before the November elections. I mean, wouldn't that be better from Bush's point of view? Boy, I'm starting to sound like a conspiracy nut, aren't I? It's just speculation. But anyhow, in the Los Angeles Times today, great article, Bush CIA at odds on Iran. just like the CIA was saying in the early days, we don't see any connection. You remember Colin Powell in 2001, in April of 2001, saying, not to worry, we've got Saddam in a box. Condoleezza Rice saying he represents no threat. And then they changed their tune. Then they changed their tune. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available at bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the city of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered a 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations went up on Monday.
Although you may be paying more for purchases, your pay may not be keeping up with the trend. According to a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than 2 decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever, for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the 500,000 mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it.
Now Bush says we're in recovery. And after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Take the A-Train. Ride that Wabash Cannonball. Hear the clickety-clack of the Orange Blossom Special. Trains are more than a part of our history. They're a rich part of our culture. But are they a part of our future? I'm not talking here about the enormous potential of long-distance trains, upgrading Amtrak and building a top-of-the-line high-speed train system between our population centers. Rather, I'm focused today on the promise of rail travel within our great metro areas. I've ridden these local systems in the Bay Area, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. They're simple, handy, efficient, fast, inexpensive, and a joyous way to get to where you're going. They also move hundreds of thousands of people a day without creating traffic jams or smog, and they create thousands of good jobs at good wages. Here's what one observer says. Mass transit is an excellent substitute for roads. These are not the words of some anti-auto earth firster, but of Paul Wyrick, an icon of right-wing thinking. To him, urban train systems make all kinds of sense and are a legitimate focus for federal, state, and local spending. Public demand for these systems is strong. Ridership is up 21% in the last 5 years. New systems in Dallas, Denver, Salt Lake City, and elsewhere are exceeding expectations, and there's a backlog of 200 local transit projects seeking federal matching funds. There's the problem. The Bushites, tagged by Wyrick as the most anti-rail administration in our country's history of mass transit, is trying to gut federal support. In their zeal for fiscal conservatism, writes Wyrick, they are prepared to scuttle one of the most successful government programs of all time. This is Jim Hightower saying, Missing the Train, a new report by the Sierra Club, highlights projects in Tampa Bay, Portland, Houston, Milwaukee, and elsewhere endangered by Bush's cuts. Get a copy, 202-675-7915.
LendingTree.com presents How to Get Out from Under Debt. First, take an average guy.
Hello.
Then add some credit card debt, a car payment, and a student loan.
How?
To get out from under all this debt, get a debt consolidation loan from LendingTree.com, where banks compete and you choose the loan that's right for you. Call 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win at LendingTree.com.
Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions may apply. See website for details.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Stem cells get to the heart of it. New Scientist, probably the premier British consumer science magazine, the high-end equivalent of Scientific American in Great Britain, or more like, you know, Science News, I suppose. Anyhow, New Scientist, great magazine. I actually subscribe to it here in the United States. It's such a good magazine on science. New Scientist. Injecting heart attack patients with stem cells taken from their bone marrow really does aid their recovery. Previous trials in animals and people have suggested the technique is beneficial, but the latest is the first to directly compare patients given stem cells with others who were not. 60 patients in Germany had operations to unblock their coronary arteries after suffering heart attacks. 30 of them also had stem cells extracted from their own bone marrow injected into the damaged artery. 6 months later, MRI scans showed that the left ventricles of these patients on average were pumping 6% more blood than those who did not get the stem cells. Now, as soon as you talk, so, you know, this looks like
It may be a breakthrough. It may be a small one. It may be a huge beginning. Nobody's really sure. They're not sure what the mechanism is, because it doesn't appear to be growing new heart muscle. It seems to be helping the arteries, and so you know the scientists admit to confusion. But the state of things, this is really important stuff. And Bernard Siegel is the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute. And where is that located, Bernard?
We're based in Coral Gables, Florida.
Coral Gables, Florida. Thank you very much. And your group has just did a conference for the United Nations on Bush administration stem cell policies and things like this. You're one
That's
of the
right.
experts on this.
We staged a science conference for the United Nations, and we brought in some of the leading stem cell scientists of the world to try to educate the United Nations on the difference between stem cell research, therapeutic cloning of stem cells specifically, and something called reproductive cloning of babies. The UN in October is going to take up a Bush administration-backed proposal to ban this form of stem cell research worldwide by treaty.
But, you know, okay, let's define some terms here before we go any further, because I have a feeling a lot of people, you know, they hear these things, these words tossed around, and somehow the Bushies and a very small slice of religious fundamentalists, those who primarily are opposed to birth control, you know, forget about abortion. I mean, they're opposed to birth control. Their whole idea is, you know, it goes back to the original kind of Catholic position, I suppose, have implanted in the minds of Americans the idea that embryonic stem cell research requires an abortion. And the reality is this has nothing to do with abortions, right? This has to do with
absolutely.
Mostly in vitro fertilization.
Exactly. The whole Roe v. Wade thing has to do with a woman's right to privacy. This is talking about cells in a dish that never on their own can turn into a human being. And
they started in a dish. They continue in a dish.
Sure. I think that the basics are that you have leftover embryos that are frozen in vitro fertilization labs that are left over from fertility treatment that are really going to be tossed out or destroyed.
Right. Now,
some of those can be donated to science.
Right. This is where if a couple is infertile because generally because the fallopian tubes have been damaged that connect the ovaries and the uterus, and that's where the sperm and egg meet generally is in the fallopian tubes, and then the fertilized ovum travels down into the uterus, implants itself, and boom, now you've got a fetus or the beginning of one, and so what they do is they draw these eggs out directly, you know, with a needle directly out of the ovaries, put them into a petri dish, add some sperm, fertilize them, and then pick out one or two and implant them in the womb. And boom, you've got a baby. But then you've also got a whole bunch of cells that are left over that have theoretically the potential to become a baby if you put them in somebody. But the labs don't do that. I mean, they charge their $5,000 for the fertilization procedure, and then they throw away the petri dish full of cells, right?
Well, basically, that's it. And some of those cells can be donated to science.
Right.
And from those cells, you will be able to extract embryonic stem cells, which have the ability to turn into any type of tissue of the human body.
Right.
That's regenerative medicine, and it's a major medical breakthrough.
And not only can they turn themselves into any part of the body, because they contain the complete human, you know, DNA sequence, so they have the potential to become any, depending on what part of the DNA is activated, to become anything in the body. But don't they also, even though they're carrying the DNA of a particular couple, don't they, because they have not yet differentiated, they have not yet become specific specialized cells, have the ability to become specialized cells in any person and not be rejected as foreign tissue?
Well, that's the point. They can turn into any kind of tissue, theoretically, if this science is allowed to advance. But in case that the body would reject it, then there is a form of embryonic stem cell research called therapeutic cloning, or somatic cell nuclear transfer, where your own tissue could be used and be reprogrammed into embryonic stem cells and be placed back in your own body without the fear of rejection. So when you hear the term therapeutic cloning, or SCNT or any of the other names, scientific names that are used for it. It's a form of embryonic stem cell research, and that is also a type of stem cell research that's under attack.
Okay, so just to clarify, you've got the fertilized ovum that has multiplied to be a couple hundred cells that have not yet differentiated. They have not yet become anything other than just these original stem cells. You presumably take out the DNA from that, the persons whose egg and sperm were used to create that, and replace it with the DNA of, say, you or me, and then allow that cell to, and then if you can figure out how to turn on the DNA, a certain portion of the DNA in that cell, it can become a new liver for me or a new pancreas for you. Is that it?
Well, that's close. If I were describing therapeutic cloning in a nutshell, I would take one of your body cells, put it in a donated egg, an unfertilized egg with the DNA removed, and then reprogram your body cell into an embryonic stem cell through that procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you had a damaged heart and you wanted to replace heart tissue, you could actually use that tissue, those embryonic stem cells, and put it into your own heart without rejection and regrow new heart muscle. That's the promise of regenerative medicine.
Yeah,
that's what this is all about.
And this sounds very straightforward. It doesn't involve abortions. It doesn't involve killing anything that could be even remotely considered a baby. And yet the Bush administration is not only opposed to it, but is trying to get an international treaty barring Tanzania from doing it. I mean, why?
Well, the why is a good question. I think that where you see science policy governed by ideological reasons and arguments, in this case, trying to motivate a political base, I mean, those are some of the reasons, perhaps, why the United States is advancing this policy. It's a Costa Rican treaty, but it is co-sponsored by the United States, and it's widely perceived that the United States is pushing so hard to get this ban in place.
Now, we have these two kind of magic words that people have these misperceptions around, one being stem cells, which, you know, because of the misinformation campaign of the religious right, people think have to do with abortions, and they don't. And then you have therapeutic cloning, which causes people to think about these people who said that they were from the planet Theta or something like that. In fact, you had sued them, didn't you? CloneAid, this company that claimed that they had produced a baby. Isn't this how you first got into this?
Well, that's right, Tom. What had happened? I've been an attorney for more than 25 years, and I had done a lot of family law in my early days. And when I heard them make this announcement in Florida, it occurred to me that someone should test them and see if they're telling the truth.
This was
not
the Raelians, right?
The Raelian movement or religious UFO cult that sponsored a company called CloneAid. So as a matter of legal principle, I actually sued them to get a guardian appointed to see of this alleged clone child. I didn't realize when I filed the case it was going to turn into a big cause celeb. But the upshot of it was, as I proved, that CloneAid was nothing more than a sham. Didn't even have a street address.
Yeah.
And yet these people had testified in Congress and appeared before the National Academy of Science and were impacting stem cell policy. And I was really shocked when I found that out.
And this was just a stunt to get new members for their cult, presumably, or something like that?
Well, I think so. What the CloneAid was all about is to get members of the Raelian movement. And they've been hugely discredited, but in part at least because of the legal action that I brought.
Mm.
But what happened is that the stem cell scientists of the world applauded my effort and reached out to me, and I formed and founded the Genetics Policy Institute and have many of the leading stem cell scientists of the world on my advisory board. And we're trying to set a legal framework to advance medical research for cures and really teach the world that there's a giant difference between stem cell research and therapeutic cloning, which is good, and reproductive cloning of babies, which is unethical science. But there's a difference between them.
Right. It's almost like we need a new language. I think that distinction is missed on most people. We're talking with attorney Bernard Siegel, who's the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute in Coral Gables, Florida, and very, very involved, right in the center of the storm, the eye of the storm of this stuff, this whole issue of cloning. What do you think, Mr. Siegel, what do you think are the chances that this ban, well, first of all, I'm curious why Costa Rica would sponsor it, and secondly, what do you think its chances are before the United Nations?
Well, I think Costa Rica in this case is probably doing the bidding of the United States, which is the major proponent of this, and the Vatican as well has come out strongly in favor of a ban on therapeutic cloning. And unfortunately, the chances are really, it's a real possibility that this ban can be imposed, that the UN will recommend a treaty to ban therapeutic cloning. A lot of pressure has been put on many countries to support this, and my group led a grassroots effort to save this research when the legal committee of the UN voted in last November, and it was saved by only a single vote. It was and then postponed for deliberations until October of this year,
yeah,
which is why we staged this science conference to hopefully educate some of the missions there in the UN that there is this difference.
Yeah, this is what Ron and Nancy Reagan are so incensed about. Now the Vatican's position, correct me if I'm wrong, is those cells in the Petri dish that have been fertilized, one or two of which are reimplanted in a woman, are actually life, and they shouldn't be thrown away. They should all be implanted, or in fact, it shouldn't even be done in a Petri dish. It's just, you know, they're opposed to that from the get-go, right? And that's
well,
the beginning.
Well, they're saying it's not that it's life. These are persons,
yeah.
You see. And the key is this: the cells in a dish never on their own can turn into a live human being. And even political right-to-lifers, I mean, people like Orrin Hatch and Trent Lott and Nancy Reagan have seen the difference and are in favor of this embryonic stem cell research. Unfortunately, the Bush administration doesn't see it that way.
Yeah. Okay. It's Bernard Siegel, the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute in Coral Gables, Florida. Is there a website there?
Yes, it's genpol.org, genpol.org.
Great. Thanks very much for being with us today, Bernard Siegel. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The latest figures from the Federal Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation say the number of underfunded pension plans dropped last year by 9%. About 1,050 pensions are collectively short some $279 billion, yet the report doesn't paint a complete picture. It only covers pension funds, which are $50 million or more in the red, and conveniently overlooks the massive underfunding that's taken place since 1999.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
"To discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work, offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species."
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I get so lost sometimes.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman, we're here with you. It's the battle in many ways, and you know, strangely and unfortunately, I think, you know, the battle between those who would want to insert religious authority into government. I mean, we've got two groups in America who aggressively want to use the power of government. You know, George Washington pointed out, you know, government can be it's like fire. You know, it can be a force that can harm or a force that can help. And you've got two groups that aggressively have sought to seize that power. The first, of course, are corporations who have been trying to seize this power since the East India Company got the Tea Act of 1773 passed, which was a huge tax cut for them, and which caused the citizens of the eastern coast of the United States they were citizens of Britain at the time, to rise up and throw the tea in the harbor in Boston. Oddly, by the way, in just the last year, Since my book on equal protection came out, telling the true story of the Boston Tea Party from original sources, from a book that was published in 1823 by one of the people who was actually there, which has been out of print for over 100 years, the ship has vanished. There's just a sign there in the harbor in Boston. Sorry, the Boston Tea Party ship is gone. Okay, I'm trying to figure out what happened to this thing. But anyhow, you had corporations trying to seize control of government power. And you have churches trying to seize control of government power. The last time churches really ran governments in the United States, we had the Salem witch trials in Massachusetts. And, you know, this is not a new thing. I mean, you know, it's a continuation of policies that have been going on in Europe for a long, long time. And that many people actually left Europe to try and get here to avoid. And Ben Franklin, of course, fled Boston because of that. So here you have, for example, George Washington writing a treaty, the Treaty of Tripoli. He helped write this thing. It was signed into law by John Adams a few years later, 1797. And it reads, quote, "As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, and as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, and as the said states never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries," etc. On February 21st, 1811, Congress tried to
apportion some money for the care of the poor. And they said, you know, okay, we're going to set aside some cash to take care of the poverty-stricken among us, and we're going to run it through a church. We're going to give the money to a church and let the church give it to the poor. And James Madison, who was president of the United States in 1811, on February 21st, 1811, vetoed it. He vetoed it. He said that this bill vests and set incorporated church and also authority to provide for the support of the poor, which would be a precedent for giving to religious societies, which as a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civic duty. In other words, you can't do that. You can't have churches doing things that the government itself should be doing. James Madison, 1811, saying, no, there's a separation here. And now in this whole debate around stem cell research, you've got the religious right trying to insert themselves, you know, and I'm telling you, the goal, the agenda of the anti-abortion folks is actually birth control. They want to stop birth control. As it was illegal in the United States, Connecticut, 1964, as I recall, was when Griswold versus Connecticut was argued before the United States Supreme Court. Should it be legal for a married couple to own birth control devices, condoms, in their own home? And there was this guy Griswold who was prosecuted for it by the state of Connecticut, a married man. So, anyhow, this is a real significant issue. It's time, number one, to get religion out of government, and number two, let's look at the science as science. And let's move forward and not have another, you know, Ronald Reagan going off with Alzheimer's. Tom Hartman with you.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the city of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered a 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations went up on Monday.
Although you may be paying more for purchases, your pay may not be keeping up with the trend. According to a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than 2 decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever, for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the half-million mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here comes the helicopter. Second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. How does this affect average people? This whole issue of stem cell research, the religious right inserting themselves into politics. We got Costa Rica trying to sponsor a UN treaty to make it illegal to do things that could literally save lives. How does this translate into stuff that people like you and me can do? Just for a brief moment here, let's speak with Richard Arvidon. Richard is the father of a daughter who is now 7 years old, Emma, who is a type 1 diabetic. That's the kind of diabetes where the pancreas gets inflamed or infected. Nobody's really sure of the mechanism, are they, Richard?
Nobody's really sure why it happens. All we know is that her pancreas doesn't produce any insulin
right.
at all.
Yeah, there's some folks think it's an autoimmune disorder. Others think it might be a virus. Whatever, the pancreas
exactly.
just melts down.
As a parent, what you're very conscious of is that there's normally about a 15-year period between initial onset and the time that serious complications emerge. And
yeah.
Emma has had this since she was a year old, so.
Yeah, it's a tough one. One of my very best friends who's my age, he's in his 50s, has had type 1 diabetes since he was 7 years old. And he's now starting to lose his vision. I mean, this is a serious
yeah,
disease.
Yeah, he's actually very fortunate he's gone that long.
Yeah, he's done very
yeah.
well. And so you have gotten involved in this thing. You're not a scientist. You're a passionate parent. And
exactly.
and I think that, you know, our listeners can probably identify with you, and what's remarkable is, I mean, this stuff has the potential for just all kinds of things. You wanted to make a point about the science that
one thing that's frequently overlooked, because everybody focuses on the applications of transplantation, and that's very important. But another thing we can do with stem cells and therapeutic cloning is it's the only way we have to grow cells that have a disease process from the most fundamental level out. So, for instance...
So we can study them.
Exactly, and we can perhaps find out what triggers type 1 diabetes,
right.
what triggers childhood leukemia, and some of these other terrible illnesses that have a genetic component to them.
Right.
And obviously, by figuring out what triggers them, we could potentially figure out how to turn that trigger off also. And that's just a tremendous possibility, and I just get so excited when I think about it.
Yeah, so the two benefits are, number one, we can essentially grow new organs or help the body regenerate itself.
At least grow cells that could be utilized by the organ.
Right.
Exactly.
And, right.
So in Emma's case, we could produce cells that would, with her pancreas, produce insulin as it's required.
Right, and so that's one option. And then the other option is we can actually grow diseased organism or diseased cells that are replicating the disease process in a petri dish so that we can examine that.
Exactly.
That is really important.
Absolutely.
Now let's get down to the grassroots stuff, because this is, I suspect you've learned some lessons that can apply to a whole lot of things, a whole lot of different areas, as well as stem cell research. But the stuff that Ron Reagan Jr., and his mother Nancy are so
passionately involved in, the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, CASCR.org, and other groups are working on. What have you done? How do you go about this? How do you create change when you're, quote, just a parent? I mean, you know, you're not a state senator or a United States senator, or, you know, you don't have, you know, $1 million in your back pocket and access to TV like Jerry Falwell. How do you make change happen?
I have to tell you, this has been one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. I found out about the possibilities of embryonic stem cell very early, and I started working on it pretty much on my own. But over the last 5 years, to have watched this genuine grassroots movement of people all over the country, you know, finding out what was happening and linking up with each other and getting involved in projects. I have met people all over the country, and it starts off maybe with an email or a telephone call, and then you're working with someone. I mean, you've got parents, you've got patients, you've got friends of patients.
Is there a central website that you started out with?
There's a real good resource is stemcellaction.org. Which is one organization, but it's entirely a grassroots group. I'm a member of it. Mm-hmm. We just had a conference out in San Francisco. It was amazing. We had 300 people there from all over the country, people literally coming from all over the world. Nobody got paid to go there. Nobody got paid to do anything to put it on. We all paid for it out of our own pockets. It was phenomenal. I mean, people are so motivated. The anger that people have that this incredible scientific research that could save our loved ones is being blocked for these bogus reasons is when you see that anger in one room being channeled into effective political work, it's a fantastic feeling.
Yeah, it must be an extraordinary process here. So, you know, groups like, you said, stemcellresearch.org.
Right, that's one of the groups, and it's we're basically ad hoc. We people work on various projects. If you have an expertise in it or an interest, you get to know other people. I know parents in California who are dealing with their children who have had spinal cord injuries. I know I know parents in Louisiana whose children have been the victims of strokes. And you just these contacts happen because you're doing work. You're moving the research forward. You're trying to give it the room to move
forward. Do you ever feel, Richard, a little bit like Galileo must have felt when the Catholic Church threatened him as a result of his saying that
I just wish we didn't have to do this. I mean, this is, if all of this wonderful energy could be used to move us really forward rather than trying to stop the barbarians at the gate. I get so upset and frustrated when I think of the thousands, tens of thousands of hours that are going into this. And if people would just use a little common sense.
Yeah, can't we boil this down, Richard, to if George Bush gets reelected, or elected for the first time, actually. I mean, you know, I don't think the Supreme Court's going to reappoint him. If George Bush gets elected here in 2004, you guys are going to continue having to fight this battle to just get, you know, basic rational science done, because they're going to continue to demagogue this thing and pander to people who don't understand that this has nothing to do with abortion and who mistakenly think it does and therefore are all hysterical about it. And
Al Gore understood this research perfectly.
Oh, sure.
He understood it in 2000.
Yeah, and if John Kerry gets elected in 2004, then in the next few years, as a result of that and his allowing then the government to fund stem cell research, we may see some of the greatest breakthroughs since the development of penicillin. Is that the bottom line?
One of the mothers I know whose child is, I think, 14 now, he was paralyzed in a freak accident when he was 6. Mm-hmm. She recently met Senator Kerry at a rally in Florida, and she told me, she said, I shook his hand and I looked in his eye and I said, we need stem cells. And she said, he looked me back in the eye and he said, you're going to have them.
Yeah. Well, you know, from his and your lips to God's ears, let us hope
let us hope that that happens. Richard, any quick advice for anybody who wants to get learn more about this, wants to get involved with this? I know there's also the Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, www.cscr.org.
Right, which is a wonderful group, and Frank Cocuzzelli, and you've been giving out his website, I know, and mm-hmm. and there is also the group called CAMRA, which is the Coalition for the Advancement of Medical Research, which is another group that's more of an institutional coalition. There are, I don't know, 140, 160 organizations, all the leading universities in the country. So there are any number of ways people can become involved, and it's a people's movement. This is politics that really matters. These aren't abstract concepts. These are people's lives, and the next election is going to determine that, and people could not be working harder.
It must be a little scary and a little awesome to think that, and you know, correct me if I'm over projecting here. I mean, I'm the parent of three children who are now all grown up, and none of them, thank God, have diabetes. But to think that the next election literally could decide the fate of your child.
I can't. You aren't overstating. I can not describe to you the anxiety level.
Yeah.
And the possibility that we could somehow lose this.
Yeah, it's got to be amazing.
Yeah, you're absolutely, yes.
Richard, thank you very much for being with us
and
sharing your story and hopefully charging some folks up and help you and Bernie before helping people understand this. What seems to be a very complex issue really boils down to fairly simple stuff, but the demagogues on the right keep trying to complicate it.
Well, I like what Orrin Hatch said about it. He said it's a really complex issue, but once you understand it, the decision is very easy.
Yeah, there you go. Richard, thanks for being on our program today.
Thanks, now.
Great to have you with us.
Okay, bye.
You're welcome. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 16 minutes before the hour. And speaking of disinformation and you know, along that path, now this, the EPA, this just came out in the news. There were inclinations about this, right? I mean, we were hearing little bits and pieces about this right after 9/11. But now it's apparent. It's the New York Post, an article by Sam Smith, just published this. An Environmental Protection Agency memo claims city and federal officials concealed data that showed lower Manhattan air was clouded with asbestos after the World Trade Center collapse. And an official sat on the alarming information even as they told the public it was safe to return downtown, the internal memo says. Testing by the City Department of Environmental Protection showed the air downtown had more than double the level of asbestos considered safe for humans, claimed federal EPA environmental scientist Kate Jenkins, who supplied the memo to the Post. Ah, here's the whistleblower. The data, which Jenkins says she culled from state records, appears damning. On the day after the attack, the memo claims city test results from the corner of Center and Chambers Streets and from the corner of Spruce and Gold Street shows asbestos concentrations at twice the level considered safe by the EPA. The city never told anybody about this. And the next day, September 13th, the city tests were so overloaded with asbestos in the air that the lab could not conclude precise amounts. And, you know, Rudy Giuliani, who's going to speak at the Republican National Convention, the guy who had his mistress move into the governor or into the mayor's mansion, Family Values Rudy, worked with the EPA to hide this from the people of his own city. I don't know how he can show his face in New York City. And moving along with the idea of, you know, are we being lied to, and if so, by whom and under what circumstances, the British government, now keep in mind, first of all, there is no First Amendment in the United Kingdom. They have a form of, you know, a legal system, a government that is based on what's called common law. It's kind of the accumulation of precedent and law over, well, literally over 1,000 years, or nearly, since 1066. And, well, even arguably before then, Jefferson talks about British common law going back to the 500s. And so there's no First Amendment, so the government cannot absolutely, you know, it is not completely constrained, like the United States government is, from protecting freedom of speech. And freedom of speech, of course, includes the freedom to lie. So, for example, when Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity go on the air and say, no matter how you count the Florida
the Florida election, George Bush won, and it's a lie. There are four different ways you could count it, including if you counted every vote cast in the state, as the consortium of newspapers did. Al Gore actually had the most votes in Florida. He actually won the state. They can go on the air knowing that that's a lie and say it, and there's no prosecution for that because you have the right to lie in the United States of America. But in England, or in the United Kingdom, if you go on the air and tell lies that you know are lies, and it's on a frequency which is licensed by the government, they will come down on you, and they just have. The British government's Office of Communications, Ofcom, right? O-F, like office, com, like communications. Ofcom is the group. The British government's Office of Communications, the official regulator of the UK's communications industries, it's like their equivalent of the FCC, recently chastised Fox News and found it in violation of various regulations in that country aimed at preventing the media from deliberately spreading misinformation. Interesting, huh? In England, it's against the law to deliberately spread misinformation. Ofcom, the Office of Communications of the British government, found that Fox News anchor John Gibson made, quote, false statements by undermining facts, end quote. Interesting. Fox News, this I'm quoting from Ofcom. Okay, this is a verbatim quote from the British equivalent of Federal Communications Commission. Fox News was therefore in breach of sections 2.1, parentheses, respect for truth, close parenthesis, 2.7, opportunity to take part, and 3.5b, parentheses, personal view programs dash opinions expressed must not rest upon false evidence, close parenthesis, of the British program code, end quote. Now, okay, it was British legalese. But the bottom line was, you can't offer false evidence. And you must have respect for truth. And the British government now has officially said Fox News does neither. Here in the United States now, people are starting to wake up to this and take them on. 3,000 local house parties last Sunday night because of the Outfoxed movie. And you're not gonna believe what happened yesterday and the day before, right out in front of Fox News. I'll show you that. I'll share that with you right after this break. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Exposing the con in conservative.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Out of His Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine.
You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. It's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Tom Hartman will be joining the exceptional faculty of the Great Rethinking, the Prophets Oxford, taking place the weekend of September 10th through 12th at Oxford University, England. You are invited to join Tom Hartman in Oxford, along with other leading visionaries, including Vandana Shiva, Helen Caldicott, and Rupert Sheldrake, among others, to rethink and reshape our collective future. The Great Rethinking Oxford premise is that this tumultuous time in our human history may be crafted into the birthing of something truly new. And you can play your part in shaping this new worldview by joining Tom Hartman September 10th through 12th. To find out how, go to the website greatmystery.org. That's greatmystery.org. Together, we will make a difference.
Children who get lots of exercise risk poor health if they breathe polluted air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Couch potatoes are in some ways healthier than kids who play soccer, run, or participate in other outdoor sports if they live in areas with high levels of air pollution. Kent Bransford is a medical doctor and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an advocacy group. He cites a recent study of children living in Southern California.
What they did is take children all growing up in the same bad air area, and then they divided them into two groups. One group, very active, playing outside like we'd probably want our kids to do. So if they were in three or more sports during the year, they were in the active group. And then the other half of the kids were living in the same area but more sedentary. So inside, playing with their Game Boys and PlayStations, etc.
Bransford says the results were surprising.
What was very worrisome is that the children that were outside, active, playing, breathing a lot of air, which children do more so for their body weight than adults, they had about a threefold increase risk of developing asthma compared to the kids who were not as active.
Another recent study looked at California college freshmen. It focused on students who had similar activity levels but compared where they grew up. Bransford says those from Southern California, where smog levels are highest, had more lung disorders than kids from Northern California, where the air is better.
Those college freshmen had decreased lung function studies at age 18, purely related on where they grew up and the air they breathe.
Bransford says air pollution can cause health problems that might last a lifetime. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, it's all going to work out. Trust me. No, seriously, I am an absolute optimist. I believe that democracy is in the genes of the American people, regardless of race, ancestry, heritage, whatever. It's been burned into us because of 228 years of history, because of the stories that we tell ourselves, even when they're not 100% accurate, about the ideals of the founders of this country and the notions. And that's one of the reasons why the cons are trying so hard to change the stories, why they're out there running around saying, the founders really wanted this to be a theocracy. They wanted the religious people to be in charge of the United States. They wanted to have the Ten Commandments on every wall. They wanted everybody, you know, worshiping the same God. They wanted everybody, you know, and it's just, it's crazy. I mean, it's just, you know, he who controls history, right? Thomas Jefferson, his famous quote, his most famous quote, is in a letter to Benjamin Rush in 1800, 3 months before he was elected president of the United States. 3 months before he was elected president of the United States. You know that famous quote? It's written on the top, on the Jefferson Monument. It says, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Put it in context. His letter to Benjamin Rush starts out, "Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution," he's talking about the First Amendment, "has given to the clergy a very favorable hope of attaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believed its own form to be the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and they, the preachers, believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as his being elected president, would be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly," wrote Thomas Jefferson, "for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of men. But that is all they have to fear from me, and enough, too, in their opinion." Jefferson's most famous quote, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of men," was said in the context of his opposition to church leaders participating in politics in the United States. And just to tell you the little thing about Fox News, 50 folks outside Fox News day before yesterday handing out outfoxed DVDs and CDs, DVDs to employees of Fox. Hey, maybe they will wake up. Maybe they'll figure out what's going on. But then the paychecks come. Maybe they won't. Who knows? Anyhow, this is Tom Harbin. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the city of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered a 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations went up on Monday.
Although you may be paying more for purchases, your pay may not be keeping up with the trend. According to a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than two decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever, for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the half-million mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Walmart, we're told, is the epitome of free enterprise in America. Work hard, be innovative, achieve efficiencies, and your company will be rewarded with riches. Oh yes, one more thing. Be sure to load up on government subsidies along the way. Good Jobs First, a research center that studies the doling out of public money to corporations, reports that the sprawling of Walmart's empire has been fueled by the steady injection of more than $1 billion from the pockets of us taxpayers, including taxes paid by local businesses that subsequently have been squeezed out of existence by Walmart's subsidized muscle. Digging into scattered, often hidden records of state and local governments, the center found 244 cases of giveaways, including construction grants, special tax breaks, and job training money. The average payout to a Walmart store was $2.8 million. Imagine being an independent pharmacy, hardware store, grocery, or other shop and having to compete with a multi-billion dollar giant that is then handed an extra $2.8 million tax-paid advantage over you. The actual subsidy is much larger, for the center was able to look at only a portion of the 2,900 Walmart stores. Also, the report covers only the direct development subsidies, not counting the huge wage subsidy it gets. Walmart pays at a poverty level and provides no health coverage for a majority of its workers, instead counting on food stamps, emergency rooms, and other publicly financed services to underwrite its workforce. Oh, tut tut, sniffed a Walmart PR flack. Don't you know that in 10 years the company has collected more than $52 billion in sales taxes that help finance local governments? Well, tut tut right back. That's not Walmart's money. So excuse us if we don't roll over in gratitude. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more and to help push for economic development policies that work for local folks, call Good Jobs First, 202-626-3780. I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George W.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
You need to buy or sell your home, but where do you start?
Sorry to interrupt, but the place to start is LendingTree.com. You can search home listings, have real estate agents compete for your business, and bankers compete for your mortgage. You can even get up to a $2,000 gift card to the Home Depot when you close with an agent certified by LendingTree. Call 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. Or visit LendingTree.com. Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions may apply. See website for details and licensing. LendingTree, Inc. is not affiliated with the Home Depot.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, all across the United States, all across the world. Yeah, it's amazing. The RadioPower.org, which beams our signal around the planet on the web, in addition to the radio stations we're on, literally from coast to coast, and the Sirius satellite, which beams us down from outer space, but RadioPower.org and Cable Radio Network also carrying the program, CRN. RadioPower.org and White Rose Society occasionally will send me statistics on who's listening. And we're over 100 countries. Over 100 countries. It just amazes me. Who would have known? I started in radio in 68 in Lansing, Michigan, and it was like, yeah, it's a local thing, you know, and now it's boom, worldwide. It's incredible. Technology. Ain't it wonderful? Studies suggest certain vegetables, such as broccoli and spinach, might help older people keep their brains sharper. They did the study on women initially, but they assume that the results can apply to men as well. They were looking at women in their 60s who ate more cruciferous and green leafy vegetables. That's broccoli, right, and Brussels sprouts. And green leafies than other women. They went on to show less overall decline over time on a bundle of tests measuring memory, verbal ability, and attention. This is an Associated Press story. Broccoli, cauliflower, romaine, lettuce, spinach. Interesting. So maybe something that more conservatives need to be doing, lest they get dizzy, you know, with all the... With all the flip-flops that George Bush is doing, first he's against campaign finance reform, then he's for it, then he's against the Homeland Security Department, then he's for it, then he's against the 9/11 Commission, then he's for it, then he's against an Iraq WMD investigation, then he's for it, then he's against nation building, then he's for it, then he's against deficits, then he's for them, then he's for free trade, then he's for tariffs on steel, then he's against them again, then he's against the U.S. taking a role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, then he pushes for a roadmap in a Palestinian state, he's for states' rights to decide on gay marriage, then he's for changing the Constitution, eliminating states' rights. First he says he'll provide money for first responders. Then he says he won't. First he says he'd help us on the way to the military. Then he cuts benefits. First he says the most important thing is to find Osama bin Laden. Then he says, I don't know where he is. I have no idea and I really don't care. First he claims to be in favor of the environment. And then he starts secretly drilling on Padre Island. He talks about helping education and then increases mandates while cutting funding. First, he says the U.S. won't negotiate with North Korea. Then it will. Then it won't. Then it will. Then it won't. Now maybe we will. He goes to Bob Jones University, then says he shouldn't have. Says he would demand a U.N. security vote on whether to sanction military action against Iraq. Later announces he would not call for a vote and just goes ahead and invades Iraq. Bush says mission accomplished banner was put up by the sailors. Then he says, no, it wasn't the sailors. It was somebody else. And I don't know if Bush himself ever got around to admitting that it was his guys. And he was for fingerprinting and photographing Mexicans who entered the U.S. Then he meets with Vicente Fox and he's against it. The list goes on, but I don't want to make you too dizzy. So we'll do some more flip-flops as time goes on. I think one of the really remarkable things that the conservatives have done in the United States is have people believe so many absurdities. Things that you have to believe to be a conservative today. That a woman can't be trusted with decisions about her own body, but multinational corporations can make decisions affecting all of mankind without regulation. You got to believe the Michael Moore's movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, was all lies. but we can't name even one. Don't you think if there was, like, one lie in it, that Faux News would have it as a headline every night? I mean, you know. They're running around going, Joe Wilson, he told a lie. Yeah, let's talk about it. Come on. Still, if a federal crime was committed. HMOs and insurance companies have the best interests of the public at heart. Yes. Oh, don't we all believe that? A president lying about an extramarital affair is an impeachable offense. But a president lying to enlist support for a war in which thousands die, tens of thousands die, is solid defense policy. Well, the key to understanding, and I know I keep coming back here, but it is so important. So many people don't get this. The key to understanding the conservative agenda is understanding that it's about power and economics. And yeah, every year at election time, they pull out of the hat things that they know in advance they will lose. With George H.W. Bush, it was a constitutional amendment to ban burning the flag. Come on. For a constitutional amendment to pass, you have to have a two-thirds vote of the House, a two-thirds vote of the Senate, and three-quarters of the states. Every single one of them has to have a two-thirds vote of their House and Senate and the signature of their governor in order to pass. That's why there's only been, you know, 20-some-odd amendments to this Constitution in 228 years. I mean, it's just it's a very, very difficult thing. 28 amendments. I mean, that's it. And we started out with 10. And by the time Jefferson was president, we were up to, I think, 12 or 13. Anyhow, flag burning, gay marrying, two-ton blocks of granite in the Alabama Supreme Court. You know, it's just stunts. But the real agenda is economic. And I want to share with you some statistics, but before I do, or some information about this. I'm not going to read numbers, but before I do, E.J. Montini is a writer for the Arizona newspaper, the Arizona Republic, and he wrote a piece back in March that has got a little clip attached to it. He talks about he got a phone call. It begins with the automated voice on my telephone answering machine saying that a call came in at 9:37 a.m. on Tuesday, that it lasted 2 minutes, which is the point where the caller's message is automatically cut off. And then he says the machine then cuts her off, and an automated voice tells me to respond to forward, press 1, to delete, press star D, to skip, press the pound key. He says, if I could this is an article that he wrote for the Arizona Republic. It's called The Anonymous Voice of America's Unemployed. He says, if I could transfer her message to each of you, I would. You can listen to it yourself by typing www.newsmedia.azcentral.com into your computer and getting to it. And, you know, he's saying, listen to this. So I want to play this. This is the phone call that A.J. Montini received on his telephone machine. He doesn't know from whom. We don't know who this person is. This anonymous person in Arizona talking about the real consequences of the conservative economic policies that started with Reagan when he declared war on labor and have taken us from 25% union workforce where roughly half of America, one person working in a family, could actually raise a family and kids, down to, right now today, 8%. This is the human face of it.
Voice call received 9:37 a.m. Tuesday, March 2nd. 2 minutes. To listen, press 0.
I'm calling in, and I'm promising myself not to cry, but I'm still worried about things that are going on in the current events. I'm wondering, has anybody noticed in America, all of us that are unemployed? I'm 43 years old, and I've been working since I was 16. My husband is 45. We've been married 22 years, and we've always worked. A year ago, I lost my job. 6 months ago, his job was outsourced to India. We have three children, one that's 18, and we were going to try to help them get through college, but anyway, I just wondered, there's so many of us, and people don't seem to notice what's going on, see nobody. You see, I read the paper, and I don't see a lot of people writing about us. And I know there's a lot of them out there because I talk to my friends every day that I used to work with, and there are no jobs. And it just seems like somebody ought to write that a lot of jobs have gone overseas, and there's no jobs in this country for people that have worked all their lives. And, I mean, yesterday I was on the phone looking around for shelters because we've got another 2 months before we're going to get thrown out of our house. And we were part of that middle class section there. This wasn't, I mean, I never thought this was supposed to happen to us. And I know there's a lot of people out there like us. So anyway, if you need somebody with rights and make the country aware that, I mean, I feel like invisible. And you go to the grocery store and it's like seeing we were an invisible section, but I think there's like millions of us. So anyway, somebody ought to write about it. And you always write about everything and you make it good. And nobody hears us.
So up to respond or forward, press 1. To delete, press star D.
And Montini then says, she is what the election in November will be about. And although she didn't leave a name and a number, I knew when she got cut off and my answering machine was listing my options that I wanted to respond to her message, wanted to forward it, had no intention of deleting it, and could not skip it. A.J. Montini in the Arizona Republic, March 4th, 2004. And so what is happening with the American economy? Well, it's starting in 1980, when Ronald Reagan came up with an idea that George Herbert Walker Bush referred to as voodoo economics. Nobody in the history of economics had ever suggested this. David Stockman, Bush's budget or Reagan's budget director, later wrote a book in which he admitted it was a crazy idea. Came up with this idea, if we give a lot of money from federal coffers to rich people, that will cause things to get better because they will then create businesses and those businesses will employ people. Now, it misses a couple of realities. The first is generally rich people are more interested in investing money. Let's buy government treasuries and get a nice predictable rate of return that's tax-free. Or let's build a factory in China. It's not necessarily going to translate into anything in the United States. And secondly, perhaps most important, so this is called supply-side economics. If we have a lot of supply, people will want to buy it. Sorry, the way economics works is, and economists from Adam Smith in 1776 forward have known this, economics are driven by demand. Entrepreneurs sit around and they don't say, gee, what should I come up with that I can push on people? They sit around asking themselves, what is it out there that people want that nobody is supplying them? Where is their demand? That's how Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression. He created the WPA. He basically gave people a paycheck. Even though it was with government money, even though he had to borrow the money, he gave people a paycheck, working people, and they spent money. And they spent that money, and that created demand in the marketplace and pulled us up out of the Depression. And the Bush doctrine is the exact opposite of that. It makes no sense. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service.
Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. 20% of Iraq veterans who were in at least five firefights are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a new study by the New England Journal of Medicine. PTSD is debilitating, causing headaches, sleeplessness, hypervigilance, and depression. The disorder has plagued a total of 12.6% of soldiers returning from Iraq, and the chances of suffering from it only increases with the amount of time spent in combat zones.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The George Bush economy. Families fall further behind. Right now we're having the biggest wage crunch in 8.5 years. Real average weekly earnings. This is from CBSMarketWatch.com. Real average weekly earnings are down 1.4% in the past year. Down. Real income. Is, by the way, our phone number 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the air. Or you have questions, comments, arguments. If maybe you can explain to me how Bush and Reagan actually could believe this stuff. Or how it is that, you know, the average person can listen to right-wing talk shows and anyhow, real average weekly earnings are down 1.4%. In the past year. That's the biggest decline since January of 96. We're basically back where we were. I mean, it's really the worst that it's been since the last Bush was in office. Do you realize that there are only two presidents in the history
of the United States who have run this government into debt at above the rate of $1 billion a minute. George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Pretty amazing. Prices are up sharply and earnings are stagnant, with prices rising 0.3%. This, again, from CBS MarketWatch. Real average weekly earnings fell 0.8% in June, the Labor Department said in a separate release. And the Associated Press noted, in the first 6 months of this year, consumer prices have gone up at an annual rate of 4.9%. Okay, so let's get this straight. Prices are up almost 5%. Wages are down 1.4%. What does the Bush wage crunch mean for the average family? Well, apparently about $500 a year. Consider an average family that faced $2,000 in monthly expenses at the beginning of the year. These expenses could include rent, mortgage payments, groceries, gas, car payments, daycare, college tuition. They've now gone up to $2,049 a month. Their weekly earnings of, say, $525.84 have gone down to $523.56. You add the two together, it's $480 a year. Almost $500 a year is how much the average American family has slid in the last year. This is the year the Bush administration is bragging about. But in 8 out of the last 11 months, real earnings actually went down. This is why they keep saying, since last summer. You know, let's compare apples to apples. What has happened to wages since last summer? In 8 of those 11 months, beginning in August of 2003 and leading through the end of June in 2004, in 8 of those 11 months, real average weekly earnings have gone down, not up. They have dropped. This is the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. The front page of the Wall Street Journal. It's fascinating to read the industrial power in America talking to itself. So far, economic recovery tilts to highest income Americans. They gain more, spend more. This is the headline. Affluent advantage is the cut line above the lead article, upper right-hand corner, above the fold, today's Wall Street Journal. They start out telling the story of a working-class Houstonian and an investor-class Houstonian. And what a difference. Many economists believe the economic recovery has indeed taken two tracks, says the Wall Street Journal. Two tracks indeed. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Stick around. We'll be right back.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
The Massachusetts Labor Board has ordered arbitration between the city of Boston and the police union. The mandatory arbitration ruling has upset union officials who had planned to set up picket lines during the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Last month, presidential hopeful John Kerry declined an invitation to speak at the U.S. Conference of Mayors being held in Boston, saying he does not believe in crossing picket lines. The 1,400-member police union has been working without a contract contract for 2 years. They have asked for a 17% pay increase over 4 years, and Mayor Thomas Menino has only offered an 11.9% increase. Last week, Menino sent a letter to state delegations asking them to ignore the picket lines at the convention. Leaders of at least 6 delegations have said that if faced with a picket line, they will not cross.
3 investment firms were fined $250,000 each by the National Association of Securities Dealers for keeping secret documents they were ordered to turn over. The files were to be given to investors involved in more than 20 lawsuits in the past 2 years against Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. In a typical move, the 3 firms neither admitted nor denied the allegations. Despite the ruling, shares of all 3 corporations went up on Monday.
Although you may be paying more for purchases, your pay may not be keeping up with the trend. According to a recent report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the hourly earnings of non-management workers, that's everyone from fry cooks to teachers, fell 1.1% in June. It's the sharpest pay drop since the recession of 1991. While hundreds of thousands of jobs have been added each month of this year, 3 years of job losses have left a surplus of workers.
The Bush administration announced another investigation into Riggs Bank for allegedly laundering money for former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Based in D.C., Riggs has been controlled by the Albritton family for more than 2 decades, who the Treasury Department has repeatedly chastised for failure to properly monitor and report suspicious transactions involving tens of millions of dollars in cash withdrawals. In May, the government levied a $25 million fine against Riggs, the largest fine ever, for failure to report suspicious account activity by Saudi and Equatorial Guinea diplomats.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Staffing services from Challenger, Gray, and Christmas tracks layoff trends in the U.S. and just announced that job cuts in the first half of 2004 topped the half-million mark. Between June of 2003 and June 2004, more than 1.1 million American workers lost their jobs in layoffs. These cuts have been concentrated most recently in the financial services and telecommunications industries. So far for the year, California leads the nation, having lost more than 312,000 jobs to layoffs.
You've been listening to WIND, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, a little time to catch your own mistakes. Yeah, I'm surprised one of the folks in the chat room didn't catch that. My error, usually you can get to the chat room, go to TomHartman.com and just click on live chat, and it'll drop you into the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. It's not $1 billion a minute, excuse me. $1 billion a day. We're going to have a deficit, which is well over $365 days in a year. The only two presidents in history to rack up debt at the rate of $1 billion a day. George H.W. Bush, in 1992, $1.093 billion per day. 1991, $1.183 billion per day. 1990, $1.029 billion a day. 3 of his 4 years. And George W., 2001, of course, we only added 0.3 billion because there was that surplus left over, remember, from Bill Clinton? But by 2002, he was up to a $1.152 billion deficit, a record, per day. Per day. 1.152. In 2003, $1.519 billion a day George Bush spent that we did not take in. Now, where did that money come from? Oh, in 2004, so far, it looks like it's going to be $1.713 billion per day. I mean, that's what it is so far on a daily basis. The highest in the history of the nation. High enough that the International Monetary Fund has warned us that we are risking going down the same road Argentina has. Where does that money come from? We borrow it. Who do we borrow it from? Well, right now we're borrowing a lot of it from the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Saudis. Therefore, the idea that you must be a Republican if you believe that trading with communists in Cuba is a terrible thing, but trading with communists in China is wonderful. Good for the economy. So, see, when Reagan, now, just consider this for a minute. When Reagan took office in 1991, the federal debt, that's the total debt, not the, you know, the deficit is how much the shortfall is every year, right? The debt is when you add up all those shortfalls. And we have had debt in the United States literally since the presidency of George Washington. In fact, George Washington's debt in 1795 was $80,747,587. And Madison got it all the way down to $45 million. He actually paid down the debt. Jefferson paid it down to $57 million. Madison got it down to $45 million. And then under Monroe, it jumped up to $103 million and went back down again. Andrew Jackson got it down to $37,000. But, you know, then it started creeping back up again. When Abe Lincoln came into office, we were at $90 million, but then he got up to $1 billion, the first $1 billion total debt, because he had to finance the Civil War. In fact, he got to $2,680,647,870 when he left office, and Andrew Jackson, Johnson came in. And it stuck around $2 billion through the administrations of Grant and Hayes and Garfield. Arthur actually got it down a little. Cleveland got it down. Harrison got it down $1.5 billion. These guys were all paying off the Civil War debt. Teddy Roosevelt up around $2 billion. And then Woodrow Wilson, World War I, it jumped from $3 billion when he came into office to $27 billion when he left. Harding and Coolidge started paying it down again. And Roosevelt came in. It was $22 billion. He ran up a fair amount of debt. He ran it up to $258 billion, where it pretty much stayed in the 200 region until Nixon came along. He got it up to $400 billion, Ford, $500 billion, Carter, $700 billion, $800 billion, and then Reagan comes into office. The first $1 trillion debt. Debt. Real money that we owe the rest of the world. And Reagan ran it from $1 trillion to $2.5 trillion. More than doubled it. And then Bush took it to $3 trillion in 1990 and then to $4 trillion in 1992. Which, you know, it's a fair amount of money, right? Clinton took it up to $5 trillion. Started to pay it off toward the end of his administration, and then Bush, too, starts out at $5 trillion, then takes it to $6 trillion, and then to $7 trillion. It's really rather startling. You know, when Reagan came into office, he inherited a federal debt of $934 billion, 34% of gross domestic product, or about $4,100 a person. When George H.W. Bush left office 12 years later, he left a federal debt of nearly $4.2 trillion, which was 66% of gross domestic product, or $13,600 per person. And now, under George W. Bush, federal debt in October 2003 hit $6.78 trillion, which is 62.6% of GDP. It's on track to hit $7.4 trillion by October of this year. That's over $25,000 for every man, woman, and child in America, which is more than the average man, woman, and child in America has. I mean, the average wage earner is in the high 20s, low 30s. But if you include babies, every single one of us, $25,000 in debt. 20 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Taxi driver number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, is on the line. Hey, number 12, how you doing?
I have a really interesting interesting tidbit of news I came across, and it was on a... Actually, I flipped to another station for a second because you had some commercial going on this one or something like that. It was about the Earth's magnetic field collapsing.
Yeah. It's been...
No zone hole, but it was about the Earth's magnetic field, which prevents satellites from being able to fly.
Well, yeah, it has a lot of impacts, yes. This is not news, number 12. It's been in the science magazines now for a couple of years.
I've read a little bit about it, but they actually had a leading news story on it. Mm-hmm. And they mentioned that somewhere in South America the field is gone, and I found it rather interesting.
There's a spot off the coast of Africa. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, what?
I was going to say, there's a spot off the coast of Africa where the field has nearly completely collapsed in the last 2 years, and that's got a lot of people very concerned. It's interesting to see the computer-generated maps of it. The best guesses are that we're probably going to go through a flip of the poles, but it might take 700 years to happen.
Yes.
But nobody knows. Nobody knows, because it's been 800,000 years since the last time it happened. So.
So if anybody wants to call in about that, I'd appreciate it. And also about this, I'll just say real quick that, you know, I think this Republican-Democrat stuff is the IRS and the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Bank, I think, is something to look at because it seems to me like it's a private for-profit corporation.
Well, it's not. It's the Fed is actually theoretically a federally chartered nonprofit corporation, but it is owned by its member banks.
Yes.
For example, in where I live here in Vermont, the nearest Fed member bank is the First Bank of Boston, which is the Federal Reserve Bank of, I think it's the First District, maybe it's the Second District. And those banks, in turn, are owned by their member banks. So, like, for example, our local Fed bank here in Montpelier, Vermont, is the Chittenden Bank. And I can buy stock in the Chittenden Bank, which owns a piece of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, which is 1/12, as I recall, of the total Fed. So theoretically, it's a private for-profit, and you can even buy into it. But it's got these weird layers where it's actually this federally chartered corporation that.
Well, of course you'd have to have layers, otherwise it would be illegal. And basically, it seems like the IRS is nothing more than the collection agency for the shareholders of the secondary owners of the Federal Reserve Bank system.
Well, the real collection holder, the real collecting arm for the Fed are the local sheriffs who enforce bankruptcies and things like that. I mean, the IRS is the collection arm for you and me, for we the people, for our government, to the extent that our government still represents you and me.
Yep. Well, anyway, it's a scam, and I don't really see, you know, it seems like it's a virus. It's like, you know, they're gonna basically, you know, kill the goose that laid the golden egg at some point in time and try to, like, declare, like, you know, they own America by economic default or something like that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people out there who make the argument that the Fed is that central banks, like, you know, our central bank experiment, I believe, started in, what was it, 1913 or 1923? I forget the year the Fed was created.
1913.
Thank you.
And passed December 23rd at midnight when everybody was home for Christmas break.
Right, yeah. And it was a very contentious thing. And there have been central banks in Europe for a long time before that, and they were viewed broadly as the economic arms of royalty, you know, of the royal families. And so this is an argument. I mean, Alexander and him and Jefferson were so on opposite sides of this thing that it led to the early schism between Jefferson and Hamilton, you know, in Adams' cabinet. And well, yep. Jefferson was vice president, but and under George Washington before that. And it's an old argument, but, you know, there are some who say this is the tool of the wealthy interest. And then there are others who say, well, the Fed is what has prevented us from having another panic, another disaster like 1929. Although there was a Fed in place in 1929, argument goes they didn't know what they were doing.
Too? I mean, like, anytime you have this, it's just basically like to run small people out of land ownership and out of solvency.
How does the Fed run people out of land ownership and county governments which collect property taxes don't?
Hold a second here. I'm out with the customer.
Okay.
There's something that just rotten in Denmark. It seems like there's a benefit to you know, the Great Dust Bowl, the Great Depression, whatever to call it, because people who own land default on it, and then it goes to the banks, and the banks have to foreclose on it, and then family farms turn into corporate farms.
Yeah, but that it's not the banks who are necessarily making the profits there. I mean, they by law they can get back their investment, but the profit goes back to the original note holder. I don't see that as the problem. I think we have structural problems in the United States, but I don't think that the Fed is the core of them. Anyhow, you got a customer, so I'll let you go. Thanks for calling number 12. Good to hear from you. And so here we have the Wall Street Journal today saying the economic recovery is for the rich, basically. And isn't this great? Isn't it great? Many have been squeezed with wages under pressure with gasoline and food prices higher. The resulting two-tier recovery, right, John Hilsenroth and Sholin Freeman in today's Wall Street Journal. The resulting two-tier recovery is showing up in vivid detail in the way Americans are spending money. This is the two Americas that John Edwards talks about. Hotel revenue was up 11% in the first 5 months of 2004 at luxury and upscale chains, but just up 3% at economy chains, according to Smith Travel Research, a market research firm. They talk about, for example, the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, a five-star resort, $600 a night to stay in this place. They are sold out through mid-October. The Bulgari stores, if I'm pronouncing that right, super high-end. Consumers are gobbling up $5,000 Australi, if I'm pronouncing that right, gold and diamond cocktail rings for the right hand. Their revenue is up 23% in the first quarter. Neiman Marcus, flourishing on sales of pricey items like $500 Manola Blahnik shoes, had a 13.5% year-over-year sales rise at stores open at least a year. On the other hand, the stores that are catering to the low end of the market, like Walmart, for example, sales up 2.2%. Payless shoes, sales down 1%. They point out, you see the same thing happening in automobiles. If you're looking at Dodge, Pontiacs, and even Mercuries, the sales actually declined or grew very slowly. Low single digits in terms of growth. But if you look at BMW, Cadillac, and Lexus, you see double-digit sales increases when you compare June of this year to June of last year. There is an economic recovery going on if you earn more than a couple $100,000 a year. And so, whenever you hear George W., a guy who was born on third base and thought he hit a triple, when you hear George W. talking about, well, yeah, there is an economic recovery, he's half right. For half of them, it's actually not half of America, it's like, 5% of America numerically. There is a recovery going on. The Wall Street Journal notes, polls suggest that Americans aren't giving the president full credit for an economic recovery, and an unusually large class divide in this recovery may help explain that. Now, I got to say, the Wall Street Journal, very often, they did a marvelous series of stories on the rationing of health care in the United States. How if you don't have health insurance, all the hoops that people have to jump through and how many people are dying as a result of it and are prematurely dying out of lack of access to health care and the type of health care that they get. They've done some pretty good pieces, and this, I think, is one of them. They quote Mr. Mackey of J.P. Morgan Chase. He estimates that in terms of dollars saved, the top 20% of households by income got 77% of the benefit of the 2003 tax cuts and roughly 50% of the 2001 tax cuts. And of stocks held by households, roughly 75% are owned by the top 20% of those households. Very straightforward. Yes, there are two Americas. And one of those two Americas is doing very well, thank you. But I think we really need to pay attention to the rest of America, too.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. Results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
A leading environmentalist says a growing gap between haves and have-nots is at the root of international terrorism. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Resentment is on the rise around the world, according to Paul Ehrlich, and it's directed at the world's wealthiest societies. Ehrlich and his wife Anne have written a new book called One with Nineveh. It argues that the growing gap between rich and poor countries is driving terrorism.
9/11 should have been more than catastrophic enough to open our eyes to dealing with the roots of terrorism. After all, we live in a world where something like 3 billion people live on $2 a day or less, while the average European cow is subsidized to a tune of $2.50 a day.
Ehrlich says he's not justifying acts of terrorism, but he says we should figure out what drives it. Most of the people drawn to terrorist groups come from desperately poor communities in places like Pakistan.
The basic root of terrorism, of course, is that many, many people are getting educated in poor countries but have no prospects for decent livings, and there are even more people who are not educated who basically just feel desperate and see the vast wealth of the rich countries, and that tends to enrage them.
Ehrlich says it's in our own interest to help fight poverty and disease in developing countries.
The gap between the rich and the poor, which is growing in the United States and between nations in many cases, is something we all should be concerned about, because remember, not only are the poor more susceptible to diseases that can move to us, but of course they also are now armed with nuclear weapons, with biological weapons, with chemical weapons, and so they are able to make lots of trouble for us, even if we thought it were ethical for us to continue to live high on the hog while they starve.
That's Paul Ehrlich, author of the new book, One with Nineveh. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hinn.
Sometimes it's bad.
When the going gets tough, yeah, we look in the mirror. Yeah, we wanna give up.
And welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Well, there are some good jobs out there. Byline Sacramento, the Los Angeles Times. Prison inmates are painting duck decoys in Indiana and Cobra sports cars in Nevada. They're making street sweeper brushes in Kansas and steel hockey sticks in Missouri. In Washington, they're turning out carabiners, metal rope fasteners for rock climbers. And in Oregon, they're sewing tough trousers for loggers. Across the country, thousands of inmates, writes Tim Reiterman, are picking up paychecks each month from private companies that have formed partnerships with state prisons, and most of the work goes on behind prison walls. In the last 8 years, the number of inmates working in such programs nationally has more than tripled. So, you want a job? Go to prison. See, this is why I say the key to understanding the conservative agenda is two words: cheap labor. Cheap labor. That just boils it right. Let's have a war on drugs. We'll put lots and lots of people in jail. We have in the United States 1/4 of all the prisoners on Earth. There are 6 billion people on this planet. You could round off our population to around 300 million. That's 3/10 of 1 billion. And there are 6 billion on the planet Earth. And we have 1/4 of all the prisoners in the world. And the vast majority of them are victims of this so-called war on drugs. Anyhow, so you want a job? Yeah, you can go to prison. The Wall Street Journal notes wage and income disparities between the rich and poor have generally been widening for nearly 20 years. Gee, what a surprise. It's been nearly 20 years since Reagan brought us voodoo economics. In 1980, they note, the Wall Street Journal notes in this article, so far economic recovery tilts to highest income Americans. In 1980, the top 10% of households and income accounted for 33% of total household income. In 2000, that had risen to 44%. It's even greater when you include capital gains. Weekly earnings, they note, adjusted for inflation, were down 2.6% in June from a year earlier. This is the largest decline since 1991, the last time a Bush was president. The University of Michigan's Consumer Confidence Index for lower-income households, off 12%. And many in this group being lower-income Americans, are also getting squeezed as health care costs rise. Companies seek to shift the burden to employers. From 2000 to 2003, out-of-pocket expenses for family medical premiums rose 49%. Time for a change, folks. We can do it on November 2nd at the ballot box. Thanks to Louise for producing our program today. Thanks to Brad Walrod for our music. Thanks to Ira Gravatt for engineering our show. Thanks to Shelby for streaming us around the world. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Jay for our theme music. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up, hanging out, and keeping me on track here. Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to you. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for re-released, the new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie...